And good morning. Sorry, we've been. This is Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio. Sorry, we've been having trouble. We've actually trying to get three guests on the line by phone, but we do have Deborah Schwarzkopf back in the studio after it's been a year and a half, and we are going to be talking once again about the very difficult subject of electroconvulsive, so-called therapy, otherwise known as electroshock, which we've covered several times with Deborah and others here on Wednesday Talk Radio. I know it's a kind of a heavy subject and it's kind of a heavy time. And we just had Super Tuesday yesterday. So lots going on in addition to the extremely serious coronavirus epidemic, which is growing in our region. A lot of people are freaked out about it. We all here at KBOO are very concerned about it. We want everybody to stay as safe as they can. But, you know, don't go overboard. Anyway, welcome back, Deborah.
Thank you very much, Paul, for having us all on. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to try to get all the guests. We do have Jane Rice, I believe, on. Michael maybe was going to call in, Michael Sturman. And we weren't able to get Sarah Hancock on just yet. So anyway, they're all electroshock survivors. I'll let Deborah talk about herself. Jane is a childhood psychiatric and shock survivor. She writes about shock and other psychiatric atrocities with goals beyond informing. She hopes also to provide solutions and encourage self-advocacy. Jane aspires to develop therapies that will help her and other shock survivors regain their abilities and have a life worth living after shock. You can find her at her website, lifeafterect.com, also on YouTube, and various other ways. And she is on the line. Good morning, Jane.
Hi, Paul. Good morning.
And Deborah, so you had reached out to me a couple weeks ago. I know you've been working hard on this issue for many years. And I just want you to tell our listeners why at this particular moment you feel it's important once again to revisit this issue. You don't seem to be coming out over the air. Go ahead.
All right. First of all, I want to say thank you, Paul, for having us all on again. A great deal of press and media will not touch this subject, given the advertising dollars and the reputations of hospitals and providers at risk for when this does come to light. So I want to give you my gratitude for exposing this. I felt it was necessary to do another show because we're still struggling in receiving adequate testing and identifying injuries. We have sustained repeated brain injuries from this procedure with every procedure, and the California courts have proved it. Yet when we go to see specialists, it's very difficult for us to get tests ordered because then they have to document the reason for the tests, and the outcomes of abnormalities would have to be tied to the electroshock, and they don't want to implicate their peers or their facilities. And so that's why it was important to readdress this, because we're still having a great deal of trouble accessing services and needed testing.
And I know there was also ongoing lawsuits that we could probably talk about, and I know that there's a petition, and we do have Sarah on the line. So I'll just let Sarah, go ahead and introduce yourself. Good morning, Sarah.
Hi, my name is Sarah Price Hancock, and I just wanted to, first of all, thank you so much for giving us the opportunity to share our experiences and concerns regarding shock treatments. Just by way of introduction, I'm a certified rehabilitation counselor and former faculty at San Diego State University's Clinical Rehabilitation Counseling Program. For the past 10 years, I've actually been researching ECT after my own experience. And I've been working to better understand how to assess the needs of people who have a history of repetitive head injury from low voltage electrical injury, which is basically what ECT is. And I've developed a petition that can be found at change.org/ patient safety ECT. And this petition is to really raise awareness that this treatment has never been safety tested. It's never been standardized. Because of that, every person who has it receives it differently, and it is connected with not only the immediate problems associated with brain injury and repetitive brain injury, but also with the delayed effects of delayed electrical injury.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that all of you are obviously well self-educated on this issue because of the intensity of your experiences and the aftermath, and so you've had to both struggle to deal with all that and further struggle to get the word out about what the ECT is all about and the abuses that are involved. So let me just turn to Jane and have you maybe backfill a little bit and just talk a little bit. We'll talk about your own experience, but maybe for listeners who aren't familiar or maybe thought that this so-called treatment, wasn't really being used anymore, talk a little bit about the history of it and its current status of the use of ECT. I know that's a big question.
Oh, yeah, it's a lot. And first off, thank you so much for bringing attention to this issue. So my name is Jane. I'm a childhood drug and electroshock survivor and former ECT proponent. I was misdiagnosed bipolar at age 11, heavy polypharmacy during my teens, and subjected to various abusive mental health interventions. At 17, I was labeled treatment resistant and ECT was suggested. I received between 60 and 90 ECT treatments over several years, the last of which left me severely disabled in my early 20s. I could barely speak, think, or take care of myself for over 5 years. Doctors refused to acknowledge and help me for years. This left me feeling crazy and thinking I was imagining my brain damage. I was only able to get cognitive testing when I was working to get my GED and I needed accommodations. It showed significant deficits, no working memory, chronic encephalopathy that my doctors would not attribute to ECT, and I still cannot get any specialist to consider this. I later learned that the true sources of my depression were related to various mismanaged health issues, sensory processing disorder, and some hidden learning disabilities, as well as issues created or exacerbated by over 15 years on psych meds, all of which are treatable, but now progress is limited due to my medically created disability and long-term drug consequences. I was fortunate to get a few years of speech and occupational therapy. However, because ECT brain damage is acknowledged, it's not research, so the therapies I had were not tailored for my condition, and, you know, as a result, you know, success was limited. The majority of my peers are not as fortunate. There are still many who haven't been able to get testing, let alone any sort of rehabilitation. Even worse, without formal diagnosis of their injuries, they are unable to access social services like Social Security, disability income, or their country's equivalent for financial support or social services that would allow them to keep a roof over their heads, assist them with everyday activities that they can no longer do on their own. Many of our peers are unable to work. Some are trapped in abusive families or with abusive spouses because they are unable to support or care for themselves independently. I've also met some that are homeless and are completely unable to fill out paperwork to apply for social services. Whatever your stance on ECT is, this is wrong. Imagine if somebody had a knee surgery that caused injuries that they weren't warned of and the doctor refused to run tests or help that patient understand or treat their symptoms. Now imagine this patient speaks out to get help and warn others, and they're being shouted down as crazy and as a horrible person because they're trying to supposedly rob other people of legitimate medical treatment because they aren't happy with their results. These doctors claim to care deeply about depressed people and because they do the extreme. And the patients who felt helped by these doctors will claim this as well, quite vehemently. But once you become an injured patient, you no longer matter to these doctors. They have no problem believing that you're depressed so they can give you ECT. But if you become injured and you try and get help, they start to gaslight you. They tell you your injuries will resolve in a certain time frame, or they will flat out deny them without doing any test to confirm. And, you know, what's interesting about this is many times when you're counseled before ECT, they indicate, you know, kind of this vague, rare chance of permanent lasting brain damage. But the thing is that they never test the patients to see if they are that exception. Never. Instead, they may blame your mental illness, push you to have more ECT or drugs, or just fire you as a patient. Now, you don't know who you are, you can't process your emotions, you can't remember what you ate for breakfast, or how to do your job, or how to care for your children. If you remember the details of their life at all, you can barely take care of yourself, find your way home from the store. You are incapable of meaningful conversation. You can't explain why this is happening or what you need. And you're stonewalled when you try to get help by not only your psychiatrist, but every single medical profession. All that compassion you got from your shock clinic dries up. You become isolated, ostracized, and this leads many, including myself, into deep suicidality. Lay people and friends have been conditioned to implicitly trust doctors and will often defer to doctors rather than believe the injured person. This is a recipe for a life of isolation, poverty, and suicide. This situation is created by the very people who claim to care about the deeply depressed. People should be disturbed by this and the fact that anyone who questions this procedure is shouted down as irrational, anti-science, or they'll call you a Scientologist, or someone who just wants depressed people to suffer. And this should concern everybody in this country. Mm-hmm. And that basically concludes my statement.
Thank you, Jane. So, you know, I've been talking to Deborah over the years about this and somewhat following this issue, and it's very the systemic nature of this in general how people with psychiatric or mental issues or emotional problems are dealt with is just across the board shocking. I see we've talked on the show about the overuse, abuse of psychiatric drugs, which seems to be analogous to me, that a lot of the people who overprescribe those don't really want to hear about the injuries that have been thoroughly documented at this point. And I know that there's a lot of people, like Deborah's said, that ECT, people who have had ECT treatments have also been subject to, as you have mentioned as well, Jane and Sarah, I believe, that also been subject to the use of psychiatric drugs, which then kind of compounds the problem. But so this issue, and again, in this, the whole issue of psychiatric drugs has not been thoroughly examined by the establishment. But the issue of testing, which seems you all are really getting at here, and I want Sarah to jump in on this, that the issue of actually that you can't get tested for your injuries because they don't want to admit that the injuries have been caused seems to be fundamentally the problem, which is really catch-22. Sarah, talk a little bit about your experiences with this and actually trying to get tested as well.
Like Jane, I had to work really hard to get the neuropsych testing. For some reason, they refuse to establish baseline brain function using like an EEG, using a functional MRI. They refuse to establish baseline brain activity using EEG as you would to measure for a standard like seizure type behavior. And yet they're telling patients that they need to reboot the brain without verifying that there is anything to reboot or demonstrating the abnormal things and how ECT would help. And then afterwards, we have no data to compare our functioning from before. So it's all patient hearsay when we say, we've been injured, I can no longer remember my own phone number, I can no longer remember my college education or my work experience. We no longer have the capacity to actually say, see, look, there's a difference. So like Jane, the only way I was able to finally get neuropsych testing completed was because I told them, I am going back to school and I need to understand how to best meet my academic needs with academic accommodations. And so they gave me the neuropsych testing, and I tested with, they called it mild cognitive impairment, with very specific deficits in executive functioning, those are the things like planning ahead, coordinating things, working memory, where you can take the information you have and actually apply it, and deficits in like visual spatial problems. So fast forward a decade, it's been a decade since I quit shock treatments against medical advice by running away from my facility. Fast forward a decade, and I was able to connect with a neurologist who specializes in electrical injury out of Denver. And he, after I had been to 8 neurologists locally, I live here in San Diego, after being to 8 neurologists, I contacted him because the neurologists were saying, oh, you have a conversion disorder, which means you're so upset by the experience you had, you've created these physical symptoms that are not really real. So they're telling me I'm, quote, malingering. And yet these injuries are gradually deteriorating. I'm actually speaking clearer now this morning. I speak most clearly in the morning than I do as the day progresses and my brain becomes tired or overstimulated. So the neurologist in Denver advised my general practitioner to write me an order for a 3 Tesla MRI with SWI sequencing. Evidently, that's the only test that could possibly see the kinds of injuries, because that is the test that can recognize micro hemorrhaging. And we're still working on trying to get an fMRI. I've not been successful in getting an fMRI because the doctors are, the insurance and the neurologist that I'm going to are refusing that assessment. But I also had what's called, I'm looking forward to getting that because I have associates in the United Kingdom who've demonstrated their injuries using a functional MRI. And then I had a video nystagmography, where it's how they assess for concussions in sports injuries, and I had more than 20 abnormalities that in watching the video of the movement, all of a sudden one of my pupils went huge. And when they turned on the lights afterwards, instead of getting smaller, my pupils became larger. So I have a very difficult time with lights. I have a very difficult time with sounds. I have a difficult time with movement. And I have so many peers, like James said, it's literally at this time, it's been absolutely just roadblock after roadblock after roadblock and trying to get the appropriate assessments and trying to get the rehabilitation in place. And we are blessed because we have been able to keep the spirit of this fight and find resources. But so many of our peers, have not been able to connect with these necessary resources because it is a constant battle to advocate for our own needs, and it's so hard to do that when we have a brain injury.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, in the nature of brain injuries seems to be compare it to professional football players, and to, you know, now that it's coming out about, you know, how veterans from, especially from Afghanistan and Iraq, have, you know, these traumatic brain injuries due to the explosions that aren't even necessarily, you know, that right next to them, that there's we're discovering how incredibly fragile and sensitive the brain is. So a lot of the research is really in some ways just coming out, been just coming out over the past decades. But what you're talking about is there is incredible resistance to studying brain injuries in football players, and we know that there's the reasons for that, because football is such a major economic and cultural phenomenon in the United States, and we know why there's a resistance to studying brain injuries in combat veterans, because obviously war is big business and no one wants to question American foreign policy. And so you're adding a whole other thing that hasn't been talked about very much at all. And I want to get back to what maybe, Deborah, you can weigh in, this whole, and all three of you, the whole issue of just being able to tell your stories. I know that, you know, there's a Mad in America website. A lot of survivors write for that and get to tell their stories. And there's other similar websites, Mind Freedom International. But in terms of, you know, mass media, or any media, maybe talk about your experiences in trying to get your stories out and possibly being denied. Anybody want to weigh in on that? Go ahead, Deborah.
Sure. I have contacted just about every single paper in every state that I could find, including the major papers, of course, and radio stations, private, independent. And only until most recently, since last July, are they willing to start to post some of these letters to the editor and some opinion pieces that I've sent in. So I'm very grateful to the papers that have done this, because they want their readers and their community to be protected and aware of what's taking place. But as far as major media touching this and telling our side of it, the truth of this, they don't expose this, because there's too many reputations of facilities and providers at stake, and the monetary details that will have to be made when this comes to full light, and they want to protect them, and plus they receive a lot of advertising dollars. So currently major media will not touch the truth of this, and so a lot of patients go into this not being fully aware of what they're signing up for.
Jane, would you like to share any stories you might have in terms of trying to get the word out?
Yes, absolutely. So, and this has been an ongoing issue that's been heavily documented by shock survivor and advocate activist Linda Andre in her book, Doctors of Deception. She basically lays out how the media kind of works, how this the American Psychiatric Association has kind of, you know, wiggled things in such a way that, you know, anytime you read an ECT article, it is basically, you're reading the same thing. Anybody who's taken English 1101 can recognize just the rehashing. I mean, technically nobody's plagiarizing anything, but it's all basically the same thing. And some of my involvement, you know, one thing shock survivors have to worry about is being taken out of context, because for the most part, any interest they have in contacting somebody who has been injured by ECT for a piece is they're just using us for ballast. But for the most part, all of the pieces generally tend to promote it. I recently did an interview with Vox, and they left out so much information. And I have been writing a piece for Mad in America on it, just about, okay, what gets left out? But unfortunately, I've been dealing with health issues. But, you know, that's kind of a common thing. Linda Andre got screwed so badly by mainstream media. One of the interviews she gave, it was eventually bought by one of the shock machine manufacturers. So her voice was actually used to help promote electroshock. So that's kind of what we're up against. You know, we have been able to get a hold of a couple of good ethical journalists, but nobody's picking up their piece, whatever they've written. And that's the state of things right now.
Well, let me just reintroduce everybody. You are listening to a Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio, your source for information about issues like this that you don't get to hear other places. And I've got Deborah Schwartzkopf, who actually, what's your website again?
It used to be ectjustice.com, but now the law firms that are pursuing the national product liability suit have taken over ownership of it.
Okay. Well, we'll post that on our website, and we'll talk more about that lawsuit again as we go on. And I've got Jane Rice and Sarah Price Hancock. All three of them have suffered numerous bouts of ECT, so-called electroshock, electroconvulsive therapy. And we're talking about what ECT is, how it's been used, and it's. We're going to talk maybe some more about its kind of current status. I said at the outset that maybe a lot of people, you know, have the image of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and Jack Nicholson getting his character getting electroshocked. And in fact, if you go on, if you put electroshock images, do a Google search, a lot of them will be of that famous image of Nicholson getting shocked, which of course is no joke in real life. And in fact, the depiction in that film is quite striking and gruesome. And those of us who haven't undergone, and I know as Jane was just saying, there's a lot of there are people who do feel like they have received benefits, and that tends to get a lot of the press. But you have here three testimonies of people who did not feel like they got any benefits. In fact, they feel like they actually got their brains severely injured and are dealing with the repercussions of that. So maybe, Deborah, you just give us an update on what happened with that class action lawsuit, which was against the manufacturer of one of the main manufacturers of these devices, right?
That's correct. It's still ongoing, and it's now progressed outside of the California courts and is national. And the California courts did prove brain injuries that result from this. And we like to think of ECT now as electroconvulsive trauma instead of treatment, because it is low voltage electrical trauma, and these damages can evolve years out to include CTE and ALS and ongoing cardiac issues.
Now, CTE is what football players get, right?
That's correct. That's correct.
And, so, and other people have repeated brain traumas, yeah.
That's correct, yes. So for myself personally, as a result of this, I have an abnormal EEG. I have lesions on MRI, frontal and temporal lobes. I have damages to my brainstem and cerebellum as well. And I have five abnormal neural cog tests. And every single procedure is a traumatic brain injury based on mechanism of trauma.
And it's important to understand So we're taking the brain that operates on a very minute amount of electricity, and we're ramming 900 milliamps. And if the person gets bilateral ECT, they put an electrode on each side of the forehead, and that charge converges on the brainstem. So if you can hear me right now, I have a little bit of a lisp. That's because I actually have chronic microbleeding in the pons area of my brainstem. And the pons area is what regulates your breathing, your autonomic processes like your heart rate, your swallowing, and speech. So you can hear I'm losing my speech. I've got my speech comes in and out, so sometimes I'm nonverbal. I use augmentative communication. But it's like you mentioned, the chronic traumatic encephalopathy, and you've mentioned the football players. Dr. Bennett Amalu is the gentleman, the doctor, the neuropathologist who originally identified the chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And I was with him in a meeting for the California Department of Rehabilitation for their Brain Injury Advisory Board. And we were discussing how to better provides rehabilitative services for people with brain injury. In that meeting, Dr. Amalu said that in looking at ECT, we need to consider it as both a repetitive head injury and as a repetitive electrical injury. So in understanding electrical injury, the electrical force of 900 milliamps is the equivalent of dropping a weight, a 73-pound weight, onto the head from a foot above it. I had that done to me 116 times. There are no limits currently in the American Psychiatric Association. There are no limits imposed on how many treatments a person can have or on how frequently they get them. So that lawsuit that they just had, shortly thereafter, the manufacturer published a list of seven risks associated with shock treatment. And those seven risks are actually seven variables specific to its administration, and they're each independent variables identified by the American Psychiatric Association. In reviewing those seven risks, I actually met five of those risks. So, you know, every single person that you meet who's had ECT will have a different outcome. The outcome dichotomy is vast because it's never administered the same way. There are no dosing schedules or dosing procedures common for evidence-based medicine, because this is not an evidence-based treatment. They do not measure the deficits. They confuse the punch-happy brain trauma as a mood improvement, or the person becomes, before ECT they were aggressive and immediately after treatment they're more docile. That's because they're living with a head trauma. I mean, we would never prescribe someone with depression or Parkinsonism or autism or severe symptoms of mania, we'd never prescribe them around in the boxing ring. That's essentially what this treatment is doing.
Well, you know, again, what it brings to mind is, you know, over the past few years, I've read a lot of the Robert Whitaker's work and a lot of other people who've talked about the history of various so-called treatments, including drugs again. And I'm reminded, what I think of is basically how the medical establishment it's almost a general approach is to, you know, when people were confined in hospitals, the development of a lot of these drugs around the same time as the development of ECT in like the early part of the 20th century was basically what you're saying is to basically keep people in line and make them docile. Anyway, it's just a thought. You can talk about that. But another thing I've been thinking about, talking about the football injuries and maybe similar for war injuries, is, as I recall, there was one specific doctor who had who basically sort of broke it open, that I'm sure there's many people involved, the whole issue of football injuries. Where are the courageous doctors? You mentioned that one doctor who are actually doing that for this issue.
Well, in America, we have Dr. Bragan. He is in his 80s. He's been an advocate from the beginning. He is a psychiatrist who, during residency, made the difficult decision to go ahead and provide the shock treatment because his colleague had refused and was fired immediately from the residency. And Dr. Bragan said that he gave the ECT and immediately was so remorseful that he has spent the remainder of his life's work in raising awareness of these issues.
But he still seems rather marginalized in the profession.
He really is. And it's because he is not worried about speaking truth. For some reason, you mentioned the One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And that movie is routinely dragged through saying, you know, this treatment is so stigmatized because of media portrayal. It's no longer like this. And they're right. There's no longer the violent shaking, because now they give you an anesthetic and they give you a muscle relaxant so that you don't break bones. But you need to understand that when you artificially alter the seizure threshold by using an anesthetic, that's what we normally give people in the ER when they will not stop a seizure. So they give them an anesthetic or a benzo to end the seizure. So in the case of ECT, we're giving people the benzo or the anesthetic and the muscle relaxant, and then because of that, we have to give them more electricity to cause a seizure. So back when they did the electric ECT before they introduced anesthesia, they actually only used 90 volts and 150 to 200 milliamps. Now they use 450 volts, like the Thymatron machine that's currently going through the court battles. They use 450 volts and 900 milliamps. Once you've had a seizure, your brain automatically creates a protective thing to prevent that from happening. So the next time they will keep increasing the electric dose. And once you get maxed out at 100% of the machine's power, then they will give you intravenous caffeine to push your body into a seizure with the electricity. But I am someone who never drank caffeine. I stopped drinking caffeine when I was 14 because I recognized that I didn't sleep if I had caffeine at lunch. So I was never consented to having intravenous caffeine. So I would wake up from ECT basically a raging, aggressive lunatic, and they'd say, "See, this is proof that you need more ECT." They never consented me to intravenous caffeine. So it's really important to understand that there are so many issues here that are not discussed with patients. We really need to address informed consent. They need to revise all of these informed consent paperworks to include the risks of brain injury as outlined in the American Psychiatric Association research. We need to recognize that, yes, the seizures are no longer as graphically violent as they were portrayed in that movie, but that movie was actually following a book by someone who'd had ECT. So it's, although it's not as violent and it's more calming for a medical doctor to witness their patient not violently seizing, we need to remember that the 900 milliamps converging on the brainstem and shooting through the frontal lobes is causing just as much, if not more, damage because it's stronger than it used to be as portrayed in that movie.
I just want to reiterate, this is KBO Community Radio. I'm Paul Rowland, the host of Wednesday Talk Radio. This is the first Wednesday show of the month that I've been featuring issues surrounding mental health and struggles for justice in the various forms of treatment or so-called treatment thereof. And I've got three survivors of what's called electroconvulsive therapy, the use of large amounts of electricity to shock the brain, which some people think is a electroconvulsive trauma, as Deborah Schwarzkopf reminds me they prefer to be called now. The issue of informed consent that Sarah Price Hancock just was talking about is perhaps one of the crucial issues. You're talking about this basically that there's structural brain changes that are caused by ECT. And Jane, I guess you all have been doing some research about this. Maybe you could talk a little bit more about that.
Oh, yeah. So there was a study that came out a while ago that Dr. Breggin kind of reviewed, and it confirmed. I mean, it was a small-scale study, but it confirmed reduced connectivity between the frontal lobes, which essentially makes ECT an electric lobotomy. And I think, at least in my experience, those connections didn't get totally severed until, like, I struggle so much with feeling emotion, things like that. And I've talked to so many other survivors that's the cure. So we're still getting lobotomies, just in electric form. And another thing, this isn't so much about structural changes, but it is about testing. There is a wonderful study that explains why current testing methods are not sensitive enough for electroshock survivors. I can't for the life of me remember the name, but I could provide the link. But, you know, it really is the perfect crime. You have a marginalized group of mentally ill people that you can just dismiss as mentally ill. There's no real means of fighting to get the testing that we need or the credibility to do so. And then much of the testing that is available is just not accurate enough. It won't provide a clear picture.
Sarah, I don't know if you have a radio on in the background or a device. It sounds like there might be a little echo, but or maybe it's just a mechanical thing. Anyway, I do apologize to people. This is usually a call-in, listener call-in show. We felt it was really important to get all these voices out there, so our lines are actually tied up by them. We actually have somewhat limited capability of calling in. Hopefully we'll increase that capacity as we.
And I'm sure Sarah and Deborah, if people wanted to contact us or reach out to us, we'd be happy to answer questions via email if that is an option.
Okay. And so
I'd like to address the structural problems. You'd mentioned structural damage, and Jane is correct. It does cause the reduced connectivity with the frontal lobe. Unfortunately, a lot of these structural injuries are so small that they cannot be seen until autopsy under a microscope. And so they...
That's a little comfort.
I know. So it causes the neuropathology of the old animal studies using just a quarter and even a sixth of the electricity. The neuropathology studies showed that the shock treatment causes gliosis, which is the death of the glial cells, the motor neuron cells. It causes myelin sheath damage and myelitosis. It causes microhemorrhaging. So these are all things which you must take into consideration as you age, you know. So I had a lot of the symptoms that I have with the severe muscle fatigue, with the respiratory paralysis that's intermittent, with the changes in my walking and my ability to process information and losing the ability to use my hands and swallow and speak. Those are all things which are going to get worse as I age, because that naturally happens as you age. Our bodies have prematurely aged because they were exposed repeatedly to 900 milliamps of electricity. So it's we really do not talk enough in the discussions of the cost-benefit analysis about what is going to be available for people as they age. We do not track the patients. We say that these injuries are rare, but it's because we don't measure them. And we all know the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. So it's really critical that they do these retrospective studies. They look at people who've had a history and begin looking at the commonalities in our symptoms, because if you compare us with the typical low voltage electrical injury patient, you will see a lot of commonalities.
Deborah?
I also just wanted to say that the structural changes in their own research shows changes to the hippocampus that you can look up on clinicaltrials.gov and other sites. I wanted to say briefly also that if this mechanism of trauma, 450 volts and greater to the brain, happened in a home or a work setting, and I, being a former level one trauma nurse, and this patient was called in that was coming in, all ER personnel would anticipate a traumatic brain injury at best, and that patient would most likely be put on a telemetry unit to monitor their heart for at least 24 hours. So they're well aware that this causes traumatic brain injury, and that's why you can't get the testing, because doctors protect doctors.
Well, that's an interesting thought. I mean, is there like research separate from ECT on the effect of electricity to the brain? Because people do get shocked. And
yeah, they actually have, if you get an electrical injury to, like, say, your foot, your hand, you can still have neurocognitive damages. So when you have direct application to the head, that's a given. And they're well aware of this.
Yeah.
Either of you?
And there's significant research out there on low voltage electrical injury. It's important to distinguish in the research. Low voltage electrical injury means anything less than 1,000 volts, and anything greater than 1,000 volts, you have the immediate neurophysical the results. But the results say static for people who have low voltage electrical injury. That actually causes a progressive deterioration, and it normally does not begin until the research says 2.5 to 10 plus years. So I just spoke with a gentleman who swears ECT saved his life. He had 13 treatments, and it happened 8 years ago, and we've actually become good friends because he was not aware that it was never standardized, that it's not regulated, et cetera, et cetera. And so we've been talking, and even though he really honestly believes that ECT saved his life, recently he's begun having swallowing issues. So even those people who have success, they feel that it helped them, they still cannot escape the natural laws of exposing the human body to such large amounts of electricity repeatedly. So, I mean, I feel bad for my friend because, like everyone, it's like, no, this can't be related. This can't be related. But he's beginning to have swallowing issues. And that's, again, that's brainstem related. The brainstem isn't even associated with mood regulation or whatnot. But that's the focal point of bilateral ECT.
Well, you know, it's obviously it's something we've talked about on this show a fair amount is, yeah, It almost seems ridiculous to talk about it, but because it's seems like an idealistic approach, but these things don't get looked at in the context of what optimal treatment would be. It's, you know, informed consent is one thing, but options are another thing. I've heard this from Deborah and other people. If you're in a situation where you're feeling, you know, some sort of desperation, or you're feeling under some pressure to resolve whatever you're going through in the moment, that can be quite serious. I myself had a manic episode, which was very dramatic, and I felt like I needed to take care of it pretty much right away without much delay. And so, you know, quite a few people feel themselves in that situation. But then if, you know, when you're in a vulnerable position and you turn to the medical establishment, the doctors for, you know, advice and for treatment, and they offer you, seems like sometimes as the way to resolve ECT, and they don't necessarily give you a range of alternatives. Whereas, you know, maybe if you're put in a very calming situation with, you know, a spa and hot tubs and massage. And I mean, maybe it sounds kind of silly, but I look at these as like shortcuts, basically. These are all shortcuts because they're technical things, whether it's drugs or ECT that, you know, there's a profit motive involved, and that it's quicker, it's easier. It doesn't involve a whole lot of personnel. Insurance can cover it because it's very clearly defined. Anybody want to tackle that issue?
It's interesting that you bring.
Let's let Jane. We haven't heard from Jane in a while. Go ahead, Jane.
Sarah made such a good point, and I'd like to build on that. It's more, and this is a little bit of a backtrack, but it's relevant. The ECT survivor's experience is a very interesting one, because we aren't brain scientists before we have it. We're told there's no explanation for it. And so when we feel that euphoria from that brain damage high, you know, and you have doctors telling you ECT is life-saving, ECT is your last hope. I mean, it's almost a mantra that you pick that up in your brain damaged state and you say that. Like I said earlier, I was an ardent defender of ECT. I believed it saved my life. But over time, as the relapses became worse and I required more and more maintenance ECT, and I started looking at my journals from the time I was having ECT, nothing had improved, really. But I just felt so, I was out of it. And there's some research by a paralegal who was defending somebody who had lost all of his autobiographical memories from ECT, that the benefit from ECT, you know, like Sarah mentioned, it's that punch drunk syndrome. It alters your brain waves and puts you in an altered state that could last a couple of years. And so that's the benefit. And there is just this, oh, it's just so hard when you hear people say, oh, it saved my, like, they're literally repeating what the doctor said. And I'm not trying to invalidate how they felt or their response, but the lack of understanding patients have for what's happening to them versus what they are being told from trusted physicians and stuff, that really skews your perception. And then you have to throw in the fact that some people, when their brain is damaged a certain way, they can't tell that they have brain damage. And it's just truly, truly terrifying. And what makes matters worse is you have psychiatrists, the way they are controlling the media's narrative with this, it basically has pro-ECT patients and anti-ECT patients, they're just kind of pitting us against each other instead of actually working towards, you know, this benefits everybody, including the people that are helped. So regardless of what side you are on this, any sort of regulation or any sort of testing or any sort of assurance that patients will not be abandoned when their brain is damaged and they can no longer function It needs to happen. These discussions, these little arguments that we keep getting cornered into with all of these things. You know, you guys were talking about One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. If you read Linda Andre's book, that was actually part of the APA's strategy. You know, look at how the media is demonizing us, and so they can play the victim. Deborah actually recently sent me a forum posted by a psychiatrist talking about how, you know, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and all kinds of media are creating stigma. But this was actually psychiatry using One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest as a weapon against anything critical against it. So I encourage anybody interested in this topic, please read Doctors of Deception. It is the most comprehensive book on electroshock.
Doctors of Deception? Okay.
Yes.
And we'll link to that.
And then you mentioned the insurance reimbursement. So here in California, looking at the financial transparency reports from the hospital, hospitals are reimbursed $3,200 per treatment. That's a 10-minute treatment with very little patient interaction because the patient is asleep. And it is basically all they need to do is to have other doctors agree that you need more. So, for example, the hospital where I received ECT treatment here in San Diego, Sharp Mesa Vista, in 2017, they provided 4,055 treatments. They grossed $13.9 million for that in 1 year for that line item alone. So we're dealing with a marginalized demographic. The people will not, they're voiceless. People who have a diagnosis are not being taken seriously when they say that they're experiencing these symptoms. People assume that we're delusional in describing them.
Listen, we only got a couple minutes left. I just want to, you know, Deborah mentioned this lawsuit. Are there any other areas where you see some little light or breach in the overall establishment?
We have the petition right now that's the change.org / patient safety ECT. And we've actually had one of our advocates internationally had a sat down meeting with the president of the Royal College of Psychiatry in the United Kingdom to discuss the auditing and the regulating and enforcing of the accreditation. Because in the UK they do have a very lax accreditation protocol, but here in the United States there is no accreditation process or any substantive way of auditing it or regulating it. So if you could really just reemphasize the importance of sharing this petition so that we can get as many signatures as possible and bring it to the attention of the public. If they understood that their tax dollars are paying for repetitive brain injury, and then their tax dollars are going to later have to be paying for all of the medical care required as people develop these neurophysical responses, needing wheelchairs, physical therapy, swallowing studies, and caregiving. I mean, we're basically funding what's going to become a larger medical problem in the long run.
Okay, well, we are just about out of time. Any last words, Deborah?
Nope.
Okay, fair enough. Well, this has been Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm the host, Paul Rowland. Coming up next is Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon. I want to thank Jane Rice, Deborah Price Hancock, Sarah Price Hancock, and Deborah Schwarzkopf. Thank you, all of you, so much.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
Okay, and stay tuned for more great programming here on KBO Community Radio.
Thank you.